Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I have a question for you to start things off today. When you look at a suspension bridge, or, the massive cables holding up an elevator, what do you see?
I see safety, I see engineering, hopefully good engineering.
Sure, absolutely. But material-wise,
I see steel. Cold, gray, industrial steel.
that's what I thought too, until I opened up this PhD thesis by Ashwin Suresh Pandit. He starts with this image that completely reframes the material. If you polish that gray industrial steel and put it under a microscope, it doesn't look gray at all.
Oh, no, it doesn't.
It looks like a seashell. It has this shimmering, iridescent quality, almost like mother of pearl.
Right, you're talking about perlite.
Exactly. And that iridescence isn't just decoration. It's a clue to how the modern world stays standing. Today, we aren't just talking about a metal. We're talking about a microscopic mystery that has frustrated metallurgists for decades. We're digging into the theory of the perlite transformation.
It sounds niche when you say the title, but perlite is arguably one of the most important structures in human history. It's the backbone of our infrastructure.
I mean, if you've ever driven a car, ridden in a lift, or crossed a bridge, you have relied on this specific atomic structure.
Completely. But here's the thing that grabbed me. It's not just one material, is it?
No, it's a bicrystal.
Right. This is the first key concept we need to unpack. Perlite is a composite. It's a mixture of two completely different phases of iron growing together,
Do you have ferrite?
which is almost pure iron soft ductile, you can bend it. And then you have cementite, which is iron carbide, and it's extremely hard and brittle.
So it's a layer cake. Soft layer, hard layer, soft layer.
Imagine it more like a brick wall where the mortar is flexible. If the whole thing were cementite, your bridge would shatter like glass the moment a heavy truck drove over it.
And if it were all ferrite?
It would just bend like a paperclip. But when you layer them, you get this incredible synergy. The hard layers stop the soft layers from deforming too much, and the soft layers stop the hard layers from cracking.
And that shimmer, that pearly look.
That's just physics showing off. The layers are so fine, we're talking microscopic spacing, that they act as a diffraction grating for light.
Okay, that makes sense.
That's actually how it got its name. Henry Sorby, back in the 19th century, saw that pearly shine and, well, he coined the term.
But today isn't a history lesson. We are looking at the mechanics of this, specifically the mystery of how these layers actually form. Because, as I understand from Pandit's thesis, the math describing this growth hasn't matched reality for a long time.
That's the diffusional debate. It's the central conflict of this research. We know what perlite is, but we've struggled to model exactly how it grows from the parent metal, austenite.
Okay, so let's set the scene for the listener. You have hot steel austenite, it's cooling down, it wants to turn into perlite. What is the logistical nightmare happening at the atomic level?
The nightmare is carbon. In the hot austenite phase, carbon is dissolved happily everywhere. It's spread out. But ferrite, the soft part of our new layer, cake, hates carbon. It has like zero room for it in its crystal lattice.
It's a minimalist's club, no carbon allowed.
Exactly. But conversely, cementite needs carbon. It's rich in it. It's iron carbide.
So as this transformation front moves forward, the growing ferrite is frantically shoving carbon away.
And the growing cementite is frantically trying to suck it in. They have to cooperate.
They do. It's called edgewise growth. They grow side by side. The ferrite rejects carbon sideways into the neighbor cementite, which consumes it.
Okay, so here is the detective story. The carbon commute. The carbon has to get from the tip of the ferrite to the tip of the cementite. The debate is, which road does it take?
Precisely. For years, there have been two main theories, and neither was perfect. This is where scientists start throwing chalk at each other.
In the red corner, we have Theory A.
Theory A is volume diffusion. This is the classic Zener-Hilliard model. It suggests that the carbon atoms swim through the bulk of the parent material, the austenite ahead of the interface, to get to the cementite.
Like swimming through a crowded pool to get to the other side.
Good analogy. But here's the problem. Zener and Hilliard ran the math, and it didn't add up. The calculated speed of the carbon swimming through the bulk was way too slow.
So if this were the only mechanism, perlite would grow much slower than we actually see under the microscope.
Okay, so the carbon is faster than the math says it should be. So theory B.
Theory B is interface or boundary diffusion. This theory argues that the carbon doesn't swim through the crowd. Instead, it sprints along the transformation front, the boundary between the old austenite and the new perlite.
A highway along the edge.
Exactly, a high-speed diffusion path. And for a long time, researchers thought this must be it. because the speed matches better.
But there was a snag here too, right?
The big one. To make the math work for boundary diffusion, previous researchers had to fudge the numbers.
Fudge them how?
They had to input unrealistic energy values. Basically, they had to assume the atoms were behaving in ways that violated other physics rules just to get the growth rate to match the experiment. They needed fudge factors.
So volume diffusion is too slow, and boundary diffusion fits the speed but breaks the laws of physics.
And that is where Ashwin Pandit enters the picture. His thesis proposes a solution that seems obvious in hindsight, but is mathematically very, very difficult to prove.
The mixed diffusion theory.
Right. He asked, why are we forcing the carbon to choose? I mean, nature rarely deals in absolutes. Pandit's model argues that carbon is diffusing through the volume and along the boundary simultaneously.
It's taking the highway and the back roads.
And the sidewalk. It uses every available path to lower its energy state. Now, saying it does both is easy. Proving it is hard, because you have to balance two different fluxes of atoms moving at different speeds. You can't just add them up, they interact.
And this is where the thesis delivered a huge insight for me. The validation. It's not just a theory. He derived a number that proves it. The activation energy.
Yes, this is the smoking gun. This is the part that makes the science click.
Walk us through this. He runs his mixed diffusion model, and the math spits out a number, 97 kilojoules per mole. To a layperson, that's just a number. Why did that number make metallurgists sit up in their chairs?
Context is everything. We know the activation energy for carbon moving through ferrite is about 70 kilojoule. That's the easy path.
Okay.
We know the energy for moving through austenite is about 135 kilojoule. That's the hard path.
And 97 sits right in the middle.
It's the Goldilocks number. It's higher than the easy path, but lower than the hard path. It makes physical sense.
I see.
Previous theories gave numbers that were way off the charts, either impossibly high or suspiciously low. But 97 feels real. It validates that the mixed diffusion model is likely capturing the actual physical reality.
The verdict is the boundary, the highway does most of the heavy lifting. It usually dominates.
But you can't ignore the volume diffusion, the swimmers, if you want the math to work without cheating.
Exactly. It bridges the gap between theory and experiment without needing fudge factors.
Okay, so we've solved the commute. We know how the atoms move. But there's another layer to this, pun intended. How does the steel decide how thick these layers should be?
This brings us to the Hall-Petch relationship. And this is vital for anyone using steel. Generally, the thinner the layers, the smaller the interlamellar spacing, the stronger the material.
Why? I mean, I get that layers are good, but why are thinner layers better?
Because metals deform by slipping. Defects in the crystal, called dislocations, move around. That's what happens when you bend a spoon.
Mm-hmm.
But boundaries, where the ferrite meets the cementite, act like walls. They stop the dislocations. If you have tons of tight layers, the dislocations have nowhere to go. They get stuck. The steel becomes incredibly strong.
And we control this with temperature.
Yes. The cooler you let the reaction happen, what we call undercooling, the finer those layers become. High heat gives you coarse layers. Low heat gives you fine layers.
But the thesis brings up a fascinating point about decision making. The steel doesn't just pick a spacing at random. There's a rule. I always assumed nature just wanted to go as fast as possible, the maximum growth rate.
That was the prevailing thought for a long time. That nature is a speed demon. But Pandit points to something more fundamental, entropy. Specifically, the maximum rate of entropy production.
Break that down.
Nature loves disorder. It wants to dissipate energy. Think of it like water flowing down a hill. It doesn't just go for the fastest singular path. It spreads out to dissipate the potential energy as efficiently as possible.
I see.
The thesis suggests that the spacing the steel chooses isn't necessarily the one that makes it grow the fastest, but the one that allows it to produce entropy most efficiently.
So it's not a race for speed, it's a race for chaos.
In a thermodynamic sense, yes.
Hmm?
And it's walking a tightrope.
Sure.
This is where we get into Sundquist's instability.
Which sounds like a psychological thriller.
It's a structural thriller. Imagine the layers growing. If they get too thin, the interface becomes unstable, the surface tension is too high, and the layer essentially snaps shut or gets overgrown.
And if they get too wide,
then the diffusion distance is too long. The carbon can't make the commute. It takes too long to get from the ferrite to the cementite. So the interface dips in and new layers nucleate in the gaps. It branches out.
So the steel is constantly self-correcting. Too wide, branch. Too narrow, delete. It finds a stable rhythm between these two catastrophes.
Exactly. It's a dynamic stability governed by entropy. It's constantly adjusting to stay in that Goldilocks zone of spacing.
Now, everything we've discussed so far is plain carbon steel, just iron and carbon.
Right. But let's be honest, in the modern world, we spice up the soup. We add manganese, chromium. This is where the thesis gets really complex.
The partitioning problem.
Right. Carbon is a tiny atom. It zips around. But manganese is a big, heavy atom. It sits in the iron lattice like a boulder.
And the question has always been, when the perlite grows, does the manganese move? Does it partition from the ferrite to the cementite like the carbon does? Or is it just too slow?
If it's too slow, the growing interface would just swallow it whole, right? Mm-hmm. Freezing it in place.
That's the no partitioning theory.
Right.
For a long time, people assumed that at lower temperatures, the manganese just got frozen in because it couldn't keep up.
But Pandit's analysis of the experimental data suggests otherwise. He shows that for manganese and chromium, partitioning does happen.
So these big boulders are moving.
They are being dragged or redistributed at the interface, and that has a massive consequence.
It acts like a brake.
A massive drag anchor, because the interface can only move as fast as these slow manganese atoms can get out of the way. This explains why adding manganese makes steel hardenable. It slows down the perlite formation so much that you have time to cool the steel down and form other structures, like martensite, if you want to.
But there's a weird side effect mentioned in the thesis, divergent perlite. This sounded like a horror movie for a metallurgist. The reaction just dies.
It's fascinating. Imagine you're holding the steel at a specific temperature. The perlite starts growing, but as it grows, the layers get wider and wider, and the growth rate drops until eventually it just stops.
Why? What kills it?
It runs out of chemical push. As the perlite grows, it's sucking carbon out of the parent austenite. But because of the way manganese messes with the thermodynamics, specifically the carbon isoactivity line, the driving force in the remaining material drops.
So it's like an engine that slowly chokes itself out.
Exactly. You end up with this half-finished, weirdly spaced structure, which usually is a defect. You don't want that.
Unless you want a divorce.
Ah, the divorce eutectoid. I love that term. It sounds so dramatic for a piece of metal, but this is actually a desired outcome sometimes,
yeah,
right?
It is. Remember how we said layers make steel strong and rigid? Sometimes you don't want rigid. If you're making ball bearings, you need to machine the steel. You need to cut it. You want it soft.
So how do you divorce the perlite?
You use a heat treatment called spheroidizing annealing. Basically, yeah, you mess with the growth conditions, usually by heating it up just below the critical temperature for a long time. Instead of forming sheets, ferrite and cementite holding hands, the cementite balls up.
It turns into little spheres or globules inside the ferrite.
They stop cooperating. They become solitary islands. This reduces the surface area and makes the steel soft and ductile. The thesis analyzes this to show how, if you understand the diffusion rules, the mixed mode diffusion, you can make this divorce happen faster and cheaper in a factory.
It's amazing that we go from atomic ballet to divorced globules just by tweaking the temperature and the ingredients.
That's the beauty of metallurgy. You're playing God with atoms. You change a variable here, and the entire structure of the material changes there.
So to wrap this up, we started with a shiny mother-of-pearl metal. We dove into the traffic jam of carbon. We saw the fight between volume and boundary diffusion.
And we found that the answer was both. The mixed diffusion model is the key. It solves the discrepancy that has existed for decades.
And that validation, that number, 97 kilojmol, I can't get over that. It's such a satisfying click. It feels like solving a riddle.
It is. It reminds us that our simple categories, it's mechanism A or mechanism B, are usually too simple for nature. Nature takes every path available to reach stability.
And that brings me to a final thought for the listener. We talked about how the steel finds stability. If the layers are too thin, they collapse. If they're too wide, they branch. It finds the middle ground to maximize entropy.
That's stability limits.
Right. As we push material science further, trying to make stronger, lighter, more impossible materials, are we approaching a fundamental limit of that stability? Can we trick atoms into holding a structure they don't want to hold, or will entropy always snap them back?
That is the frontier of nanotechnology.
Yeah.
How far can we push the disorder before the system rebels?
Something to mull over the next time you step into an elevator. There is a relentless, chaotic, yet perfectly ordered atomic dance holding you up. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.
See you next time.